Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Writer Eamon Sweeney, welcome.
Thanks, Brendan.
Eamon, sports fans will know you're columnist with The Independent, but you're also the author of several books, including, I think, let us say, two great, great Irish novels back in the day, Waiting for the Healer and the Photograph. People should check them out. But you wrote a hugely popular book in 2024, The Road to Croker, and it kind of charted a GAA championship season. And you've finally written a follow-up, The Last Ditch, and it's very funny and warm, and it's quite a beautiful journey through last year's GAA championship. But like everything interesting, it's a little bit more complicated than that. The subtitle of the book is How One GAA Championship Gave a Sports Writer Back His Life. So we'll come to that bit. I suppose we should know your county credentials, first of all. So you're a Sligo man, but other mixed allegiances as well, yeah?
I'm a Sligo man. My father was from Kilkenny. My mother is from Galway. I've been living in West Cork for the last 25 years. So I'm kind of surrounded family-wise by fans of other counties, you know.
Okay. And I believe your relationship with your mother very much based on post-match analysis, yeah?
It really is. I mean, we have a phone call. Well, we talk to each other quite a lot. We have a phone call every Sunday to kind of discuss whatever has happened in sport during the week and that, you know. And even my mother had a stroke, which I talk about in the book. And she had that a few hours after the All-Ireland hurling final. And, you know, we'd spoken about that. And I kind of, in a way, most of my kind of family landmarks with my mother are marked off on the GAA, you know.
Yeah.
She'll be listening to this at the moment.
And is her analysis still sharp, yeah?
Her analysis is very sharp, though slightly biased. It tends to be kind of very pro Galway. She tends to see very little good in referees.
and come here, you kind of rebuild your relationship with your dad through sport as well, didn't
I did as well. I mean, you know, my parents separated when I was in my teens, and my father kind of went off the scene for a bit, and you know, we kind of rebuilt it in a way. I suppose it's a kind of the Irish man thing. What can you really talk about? And we kind of rebuilt it by kind of going, when I was living in Dublin, he was living in Dublin, we go to games together and
of course you weren't even standing facing each other, like you could talk side on to
we could have, yeah. It was one of these classic kind of Irish father and son relationships, you know. The match was doing a lot of heavy lifting for all kinds of other stuff. It was a metaphor maybe for other things, you know.
What you convey very well in the book, one of the things, is what the GAA means to people. So you mentioned West Cork. Castlehaven in West Cork, and it pops up in the previous book as well. You say this is the first time, I think, that you really viscerally understood what the GAA means to people, like in towns and villages and stuff. It's the first time you felt kind of part of it as well, is it?
Yeah, I think there's something. Castlehaven is one of these places where the GAA is so close to the community, it's hard to tell which is the GAA and which is the community. Yeah. I mean, it's just quintessential kind of GAA club. It's a GAA club based on two small villages and a lot of hinterland, which is one of the most powerful senior clubs in Munster. You know, what really brought it home to me was, I remember about 12, 13 years ago, Castlehaven got to the county final for the first time in years and they lost it. And I thought, will I go down to Union Hall to the afters of it? It'll be like a funeral, I thought. It'll be like a morgue down there. But I thought, well, you know, you might as well do it. And I got down there and the place was packed. And it was exactly as if they had won the thing, except that nobody mentioned the game. And the, and the players were all there, but everyone was full of cheer and talking to the players and so on. And at one stage, one of the players, the full back at the time, snapped and he said, "This is terrible. You're making me feel worse now for losing." He said, "You know, I'd prefer if you were giving out to me, you know." But the key thing was that they came back the next year and they won it. And I always thought they set it up to win it, I think, the next year by their kind of grace and defeat. And Castlehaven, I just think it's a wonderful thing. I mean, the GAA is a wonderful thing. I'm just sitting here with you and I'm thinking there's Cork people going to Ennis, there's Roscommon people going to Galway, there's, you know, Donegal people going across to Clonus, and people going from Limerick to Thurles. And like in a world which, you know, which is so full of nastiness and awfulness and so on, you know, can you imagine any more benign thing than gathering the clan together and off to a game on a Sunday afternoon to watch it with your friends and your neighbours and chance acquaintances, you know.
And that's a picture you paint very well as well of the people travelling, the texture and the rituals of that and the random encounters you have. To which, now, so you weren't sure you could do this book. So first off, you're obviously a very different person now to when you did the first one. You're older, you don't drink anymore. So there were all those kind of things. But your real reluctance was the fear of that travelling to the matches. So was it 25 years ago you had your first panic attack?
24 years ago in 2000 in Killarney, yeah.
What happened?
I was going to a game in Killarney, Kerry and Cork, normal. A couple of days ago before, I'd been going to Bandon, and on the way into Bandon I was struck by this kind of uneasiness. It's hard to say. It was like a mild hangover. It was, you know, just a bit below the weather. And I said to the person in the car, well, she says, I don't know, can I keep going to Cork? So we went into a doctor and he said, have a couple of these Xanax. He said, they'll calm you down. You'll be okay. So I had them. I was grand. I thought no more of it. And on the Sunday, I was going to the game in Killarney. I got to Killarney. I walked into the stand. I was about to go across to the press box and I was struck by, I mean, I can only describe it as kind of like being hit by a bolt from the blue, you know, which just sounds like a bit of a cliche. But I suddenly my heart started pounding as though it was going to come out of my chest. I started pouring with sweat. I started crying. I couldn't move. I was paralysed. I felt like I was just going to collapse right down there. I was terrified, you know. I'll never forget the feeling of it, actually.
And you didn't know what it was, obviously.
I didn't know what it was. I thought, am I having a heart attack? Am I? Probably not. I thought, I'm a young enough man. And besides, I'm getting all this other stuff as well. This feeling of bottomless dread. And at the time, there's very little talk about mental health and that at the time, or anxiety or depression and so on. So all I could actually think was, I'm going mad.
Yeah.
You know, I'm losing my mind. What has happened to me? And it was just an incredibly frightening moment. You know,
I have no idea why.
Hadn't a clue. What I've done counselling since. I've delved into this, that and the other. No one. I mean, I've a happy life. You know, I didn't have a traumatic childhood. I like my job. I get on well with my kids. There's nothing bad in my life, you know, and I'm not depressed. I'm not. In fact, I'm one of life's great enthusiasts. I'm always like, this is great. That's great. Look at this. You know, I'm a kind of a sunny character. But this had hit me out of the blue, and I'll never forget it. There was sweat pouring off. I remember when I kind of managed to advance around to the press box. Feeling that the back of my shirt was absolutely soaked, as if someone had thrown a bucket of water on it, you know. So my face, I remember, was shaking. My head was shaking, you know.
And you probably never heard of a panic attack either, had you?
No. This is like I said, this is a thing now. You can't, which is a great thing. People will talk about anxiety, depression, panic attacks, whatever. At the time, I thought, you know, the only analogy I had for madness was that I'd done King Lear for the Leaving Cert, you know.
Yeah.
And I was kind of picturing, that was all I could think of in terms, it was like, you know, King Lear running around in the storm, raving, you know.
So then for the rest of the summer, I think you kind of, like we talk about people taking to the bed, you took to a deck chair.
I got the game done that day and I thought, you know, managed to get home. And then over the next few weeks, things just got worse and worse and worse. I became petrified. And at the time, I was living in Castle Townsend in the village, and there was a shop just up for me, 100 yards away. The guy was a friend of mine. I'd go up every day to talk about GA. And I couldn't get... I'd spent 3 months, I didn't get as far as that shop. I'd stay awake all night sitting on a couch. I was too afraid to go asleep. And in the morning, I'd stumble out to this deck chair out in the yard, and I'd sit out in it, looking at the sky. That was all I was fit for.
Jeez.
And at the end of the day, I'd kind of collapse out of the deck chair and I'd crawl into the house. And this went on for 3 months. And I'll never forget it. If somebody had said to me, you'll have this for 3 months, it wouldn't have been too bad. But yeah. but I kind of thought, is this ever going to end? Yeah. Am I ever going to sleep again? I mean, I spent about 3 months up at night watching Transworld Sport at six in the morning, you know.
So was it agoraphobia? We need to hear about agoraphobia. Is that what it was?
I mean, I don't know. I think it is maybe agoraphobia. I don't know.
But
I
you
mean,
were afraid to leave the house. At its worst, I was
afraid to leave the house. And then I rallied. I went on medication. I rallied. I got back to the end of that championship. And then over years, it started chipping away bit by bit. The following year, myself and the girlfriend at the time, was the mother of my kids, were going to Venice. We went to Venice on holiday, and coming back at the plane in Venice, I got into a total panic. I got into such a panic they let me off the plane, which was on the runway getting ready to take off, which took some doing, you know. I'm kind of lucky they didn't shoot me actually, but that was planes gone. A few years later, I was going to my daughter's christening, which was out in Cape Clear. Couldn't get a boat. Managed again, pulled myself together, got the boat. Managed to prevent myself from jumping off the boat on the way back, and thought, no, that's it. Never again. You know, I could...
So the way you put it in the book is that your world started getting smaller then for years. Like, did you become kind of reclusive?
I did become reclusive. I spent a year where I didn't go beyond Skibbereen. I think I went to Dublin, I think, once in 5 years. About 2000, and the train I could manage. But generally, actually, after, if I had a couple of pints in like the station bar, I could struggle it out. And then about 2009, I got hit by such a panic leaving Galway to go up, I think, to see Ireland playing Australia in rugby, that I jumped off the train and left.
What's going on in your head? Like, you get in the train, you're thinking, I can do this.
What's going on in my head was dread. If I stay in this space, something terrible is going to happen. Part of it maybe was I didn't want to be, you know, I suppose I don't want to throw the head altogether here and people to be looking at me. Or I suppose these days I could end up on TikTok as, you know, mad Irish train man goes berserk. You know, I could be selling T-shirts of it. But also, no, it's just a feeling of dread that I would tip over the edge, that I would go kind of completely crackers, you know.
And never come back.
And never come back.
So then... they get on to you looking for a book, and you're still kind of, we'll call it, averse to travel. So I presume your initial response is, I cannot travel all over the country.
Well,
about summer.
10 weeks before they rang me, I'd had the worst panic attack. I'd managed to kind of stir myself into getting back on trains, and I was going from the train from Galway to Limerick, that kind of small train, and that is, I think, the closest I've gone to tipping over into psychosis. It was genuinely very, very scary. You know, I literally was shaking from head to toe. I roamed around Galway. I think there might have been... I remember I got a taxi out to Spittle, and your man, actually, I'd say, was somewhat wary of me. There was probably a certain amount of talking to myself and gnashing of teeth and so on. So I eventually made it home after... You know, I remember I made it home. It took me about, I got on and off about three buses to get as far as Cork. And I came home and I said, look, that's it, Eamon. You can't beat this. Look, you're happy enough. You have your books. You have your kids. You're going to stay at home for the rest of your life, and you're never going to go out again. And then Ciara Considine from Hachette rings me up and goes, I have a great idea. What we should do is we should do the book again, and you can travel all over Ireland. So I was like, oh yeah, you know, yeah, now you tell me. And I spent basically weeks, as one of my daughters said, ghosting her. I wouldn't answer any of the emails, and then I answered a couple of emails, and I tried to kind of be a bit kind of, well, I've got quite a lot on, Ciara, you know, and I'm hoping to write a novel, and, you know, just anthem but to do this book. But then she kept on to me, and my daughters actually said to me, well, maybe this is what you need. Maybe this is the, you know, shit or get off the pot. I mean, maybe this is the moment to try and do this. Take it seriously. See how far you get.
Okay.
And if you can't do it, then you can't do it. So
what happened when you tried?
Well, actually, the first thing I did was, yeah, this is brilliant. This is it, you know, down with fear. And I got up the next day and I went into Skibbereen and to get the bus as far as Cork, and I couldn't get on the bus. So that was number one. But over time, right, I went to a doctor. I spoke to a doctor. I went to a psychologist. I went on medication. And I started to feel, bit by bit, I started to feel a bit better. I managed to get the bus to Clann, shaking like a leaf. You know, I was like, it was like when Michael Palin gets the dhow across the Arabian Sea, you know, or one of these, you know, a camel across Africa. Yeah. The man goes from Skib to Clann on the bus. I mean, it's ridiculous when you think of it, but for me, this was a huge journey, you know. So then got done bit by bit, but then the killer was the train. I said, if you haven't got a train by the new year, you'll have to, unfortunately, throw in the towel on this one. So we were up in Galway and I went several times to Galway to get the train, and I'd walk onto the station and I'd buy the ticket and I'd walk down the platform, and as I was approaching the platform, I'd turn back. I'd just be filled by this enormous dread. The only way I could compare it is, I don't know, if you watch a vampire movie and let's say Van Helsing goes into a place in Transylvania and he says to the locals, has anyone any directions for Castle Dracula? Okay. I mean, I kind of felt like the locals feel about Castle Dracula. It was just, I can't get on the train. It'll be terrible. I'll start banging my head off the wall. So I got off, I remember my final try. I walked away from the station, I walked through Air Square, I walked across past Supermax, past the Imperial Hotel, and then I thought, you can't live your life like this. And I had a masterstroke. I thought, if I'm scared of getting the train out of Galway, I'll get a bus to a rural station which is quiet where no one is looking at me. So I got a train to Ardrahan. And when I got to Ardrahan, I couldn't find the train station. And I couldn't actually find any people either. So I spent a half an hour going around Ardrahan in the cold, trying to flag down tractors and that, so someone would tell me where the train station was. I don't know if you've ever been in the Ardrahan train station. It's about a mile and a half out of town along a country road with no footpath. I don't know why you'd put a train station there. And I got there, and it was like one of those spaghetti western train stations. You know, the wind was creaking. There was no one else there. There was the line. There was everything but a vulture on top of the station sign. And I waited and waited, and I said, this is it. And the train came along, and I said to myself as I got on, this is it now. I can just get on myself. And as I was getting on the train, four teenagers hopped out of a car and they were getting on the train. I said, well, I'll be grand. I'll sit me on. I'll be sound as long as the four teenagers don't jump into the seat beside me. So I got in the train and the four teenagers jumped into the seat beside me. And I was like, and the train closed. And I was looking at the red button and I thought, I can still do it. I can still back out. And the train moved off and headed for Crockwell. And as we were heading for Crockwell, I thought, I could feel something falling away from me. You know, I actually thought, geez, I'm back on a train. Yeah. You know, I'm back on a train going to Crockwell. And since then, I've left no train. I mean, I came up yesterday.
One small step for man.
I'm not joking. I mean, it's terrible. I was like, you know, I mean, it's hardly Paul Theroux now traversing Asia. But the thing is, it has its consolations. I got off yesterday an ordinary train from Cork to Dublin, and I'm getting off at Houston Station. I was filled with exhilaration. I don't think that's ever going to leave me. I thought, yeah. Jeez, I'm getting
a childlike sense of wonder at the train. Yeah.
Because I was as likely to get a train, to be honest, as I was to get, you know, Elon Musk's SpaceX flight to Mars in my own mind, you know?
So come here. So you started travelling around, and actually it's in the travelling around on the train and then in the stands as well that a lot of the beauty of this book is in the texture, the banter, the kind of dynamic between all the fans and everything, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I love it. That's the one thing. I suppose the only way I could compare it is people probably remember lockdown. I mean, I'd been in my own lockdown for a decade, and suddenly I'm out and I'm meeting people and I'm talking to people and I'm having, you know, conversations with people. Because I mean, I love the GA. And one of the reasons I love the GA is I love the people. I am kind of someone, I generally see the best in everyone. And what I love is that GA dynamic where people feel compelled to talk to you.
Yeah.
You know, you sit down beside a guy or a woman at a match and they are compelled to launch into it and tell you their story and, you know, pass comment on the match and everything, which is fantastic. Or even on the train, for some reason, maybe I'm lonely looking or something, but any time I got on the train, somebody had decided they'd tell me their life story, you know?
Yeah. You talk as well, there's a few incidents of where people lose their heads at matches, like, and then afterwards kind of calm down a bit and go around apologising.
Oh yeah, we were at the All-Ireland semi-final in Cork and Limerick, which is great. Like, this is a classic example. A guy sat in beside me and he goes, Finbar and Eamon, you know.
Yeah.
And like, for the whole, it was a brief encounter. It was like kind of GA love at first sight, you know. every you know, Cork got a couple of early scores and suddenly we were up together, you know, kind of, you know, like shaking our fists at each other and roaring at each other, like something you'd see, you know, 60s footage of two teenage girls at a Beatles concert, and we're into that, you know, and the whole game is myself and Finbar, and we're hugging each other, and it's, you know, manly love, as they'd say. And but as the game went on and it became apparent that Cork were going to win, there was a guy about two doors down from us, a shaven-headed Limerick guy, who started to shower the Cork team with abuse, the most vile abuse, you know, and then would look back as us, as if to say, yeah, well, what are you going to do about it, you know?
Yeah.
And Finbar was spurred on by this. And every time your man would do this, your man would be, Finbar would be, come on, the rebels, come on, the rebels. And your man would be getting worse and worse and worse. And I was thinking, I don't know if this wise Finbar, because this was a big lad. Like I said, he was someone who looked like he'd either be doing the bouncer in a nightclub or he'd be getting thrown out by the bouncers in a nightclub. And he had two buddies with him. So anyway, the game ended. Cork won. Finbar was, you know, jigging up and down. So was I, more embracing. And the next thing we see, your man making his way up the stand towards us. And I was thinking, geez, this might be slightly tasty, you know. And he comes up to us and he goes, I'm really sorry, lads. I lose the run of myself at games. He says, you know how it is. He said, well done and good luck in the final and so on. And, you know, we were...
No, but listen, he let out whatever he needed to let out anyway.
Yeah, it was gone. Because that's the GAA for you. It's not... The reason I think, in a way, there's no GAA hooliganism is that people think it's so against the grain, it would look silly.
Yeah.
Do you know, it's just not the thing.
Yeah. Come here, the other rituals you talk about. So a lot of country people get mass in Dublin and that when they come up for to Croke Park for a match day. You started taking mass around various religions on match days.
It was just a kind of an interest I had. I thought I was up in Dublin. Actually, I hadn't been in Dublin so long. Dublin has changed. Dublin is a more multicultural place. And I read a lot of Russian literature and Dostoevsky and this. And there's always a bit in Russian literature where they go to a Russian Orthodox service. So I thought, I wonder what they're like. So I went to a Romanian Orthodox service in Leeson Park. And that was great. And I went to a Russian one in Harold's Cross. And then one day I was going through Rathmines and I was going across by St Mary's College, the rugby pitches there, and I heard this most fantastic singing. And I went in and it turned out there was an Indian branch of the Syriac Church, who's like the oldest, one of the oldest Christian churches in the world. And their whole thing was based on singing and everything. And they were tremendously... Everyone was tremendously nice to me, even though when I went in first, the men and the women sat in separate aisles and I went to side with the women. I kind of copped after about 5 minutes. But then I sat on my own and, you know, guys came way down the church to shake my hand. When I went out to the Russian Orthodox Church, I wanted to buy a small icon as a souvenir. I found I had no money on me. Your one waved it off, you know. Everywhere I went, I went to the mosque down in the South Circular Road, even though there wasn't a service on, where they were very, very friendly.
And then the match day feed as well. You got experimental about that as well.
The match, yeah, I did. I started eating. There's a joint in Moore Street, the Moore Street Mall, which is in a way I think kind of sums up a kind of an immigrant experience in Ireland, where you go down this kind of step of stairs into this kind of subterranean spot, and there's food from the Balkans, and there's food from Bolivia, and there's Brazil and Georgia, and all these places, and there's places there where people can send people home and send money home, sorry. Mm-hmm. There's places where people can get their furniture delivered from abroad and, you know, cash money and so on. And it's, you know, it's not the fanciest place, but I used to go there every Sunday and it was part of the ritual. And again, people are kind of delighted that you were taking an interest, you know?
Yeah. Listen, you missed a few games, because of your daughter Isabel, and it sounds like you two have a great relationship. And as you say in the book, Isabel can tell her own story when she wants. But tell me a little bit about Isabel from her dad's perspective.
Well, from Isabel is on the autistic spectrum, and she. One of the parts of that is she had a lot of health struggles as a child. We were told at one stage that she was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. They kind of undiagnosed that subsequently. We were told at another stage she might have to always walk with sticks. We were told another time she was going to be in the smallest 5% of people. And none of these things came. None of these things came through.
Yeah,
you know,
they're great with the good news for people. Yeah, in these situations, set the expectations.
None
low.
Of these things came true. But one thing Isabel has. Was a thing called selective mutism, where she didn't really speak. And I went through, I suppose, the first maybe 15, 16 years of Isabel's life. We'd never had a conversation. We were close. We went around. We did things together. And we never had a conversation. And I honestly thought to myself, well, I'll die without ever having had a conversation with my daughter, who I love very, very much. Yeah. And then bit by bit over the last few years, she's begun to speak, and it's been a fantastic thing. I mean, she's really kind of, she's enriched my life in a way. I often think, you know, she gives me an entirely different view on the world. You know, I look at, you know, let's say, not without getting too political, but the Trump idea of the world, where there's the normal people, and people outside the norm are losers and freaks, and, you know, they need to get the boot put into them. And I think through, you know, I look at Isabel, who's this marvelous artist, and has this magnificent memory, and is the most benign, decent person I've ever met in my life, who can't bear any kind of cruelty and so on. And I think in ways she's superior to me, you know.
Yeah.
But just the last few years. I mean, it's funny how she started speaking, she started playing, we would be playing video games, and she wouldn't be able to resist herself making a comment. And then bit by bit we got through that, and then we start talking about films. But, you know, she's great. We were talking the other evening, and we watched a film, Nope, myself and her sister and herself, and myself and the sister were, you know, raving about it in, you know, cinematic terms, and, you know, kind of poncing it up very much. And Isabel suddenly interjects, she goes, I disagree, she said. It's very boring, you know. So now that she's started talking, what she mainly does is disagree with us, which
okay,
is very
so
good.
She's contrary, it turns out.
But it's been you know, because I knew very little about autism
it must have been incredible the first time she spoke to you, was it?
Yeah, we're just there. I remember we went for a walk, and you know, we're kind of she knocked a few words out of herself, and I was like, the briefest conversation I have with Isabel is an occasion of wonder for me. You know, yeah. It's a fantastic thing about the most routine things. And now we're away. She's obsessed with Hollywood. You know, I'll just say to her, Isabel, what are the next films coming out in Hollywood? And she'll list out everything that's coming out for the next year.
So she was just waiting on the time was right.
She's very, very bright in that when, you know, if we watch a film, if we watch a comedy, Isabel is getting the jokes the same as everyone else. But I mean, autism is one. I mean, I think sometimes that science knows more about, you know, the origin of the universe or what's going on at the far end of the galaxy than it does about autism. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. How is your own journey now? Have you left the country?
I have. Yeah? I have. Since I finished the book, I went to Paris and I went to Amsterdam. And it's just... And honestly, before I wrote the book, that would have been like going to Mars. That was another thing I was resigned to. I would never going to leave this country. But I've been to Paris, I've been to Amsterdam, and it was like, you know, it was incredible. And I'm feeling good, mind you. I still haven't, you know, I'm taking it easy, you know. But I think the monkey is off the back, you know.
Yeah, yeah, but not losing the run of yourself yet.
I'm not losing. I haven't taken up hang gliding or anything at all.
There's lots of texts of people empathising with the panic attacks, but this is the most honest, lyrical and funny discussion on what it's like to have panic attacks, agoraphobia. I too developed it out of nowhere in 2018, still a spectre. I'm so much better than I was, though. Gaurav Mahagud, for this content, you never know who it may help. And lots of people saying they're big fans of your writing and everything, and how you're describing exactly what it's been like for them. And most importantly, there is a 5-minute walking shortcut from the village of Ardrahan to the station. Now they tell you.
Now they tell me.
By the way, just briefly, we should reflect on the championship. So basically, you said after the football final, you were worn down with what football had become. The hurling final last year, you think, one of the greatest sporting occasions you ever saw.
Yeah, the hurling final last year in Cork and Clare, like I said, it seemed to last forever. You know, there was so much good stuff in it, so much interesting stuff in it. And I mean, they go at it again today in Ennis, which should be magnificent. It was the best hurling championship I'd ever seen and the worst football championship I'd ever seen, which had its own fascination. It was like watching the downfall of the Soviet Union or something. But subsequently, they've changed the rules. Kerry Cork played a great game last night. So this year, I think we're probably going to have great football championships, great hurling championships and great crack, you know?
Yeah, and you'll be there to enjoy it all.
I will indeed. I'd have been at Kerry Cork last night, except I had to come up and do something on RTE.
Okay, listen, well done. The Last Ditch is published by Hachette. It's a terrific book. Eamon Sweeney, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Brendan. Cheers.
Email brendan@rte.ie.